Cresta in the Afternoon is a co-production of Ave Maria Radio and EWTN Radio and carried across the EWTN Global Catholic Radio Network.
With the New York Times in one hand and the Catechism of the Catholic Church in the other, Al Cresta is ready for conversations of consequence.
America is as divided as it has been in 150 years.
Politics is symptomatic of the culture.
They don't have a personal relationship with Christ.
We've been sacramentalized, but not evangelized.
Why should Washington listen to us when our own house is in disarray?
The church's greatest riches are her people.
Share the contagious joy of being a friend of Christ.
Story after story after story. Story of people who have had inexplicable healings.
Broadcasting from the studios of Ave Maria Radio in Ann Arbor, Michigan, and taking a closer Catholic look at current events, issues, and ideas. This is Cresta in the Afternoon.
That's beautifully said, Al.
Thanks for your voice for liberty.
It's like a homecoming each time on your program. It's
clear to me that you've thought these things through at a deep level.
Let's build the church, and then we'll bless the nations. Good afternoon. I'm Al Cresta. Thanking you for joining me. We've got 2 hours talking about the things that matter most. Dr. Gregory Popcheck joining us, taking a look at some of the health benefits that religion brings to people who are faithful to their deepest commitments. We're also going to talk with Dr. Matthew Bunsen about the Amazonian Synod that's going on. A Brazilian bishop saying that infanticide is shocking, but the church has largely eliminated it in his region of of Brazil. And then we're going to be joined by Dr. John Birnbaum. He's an evangelical Protestant leader who helped create the first Christian liberal arts university in Russia. This is after the Berlin Wall fell. It's a story that really bears our attention because it brings together the collapse of Soviet-style communism, a period of time where there was really an open door for Christians to come in there, share their faith, cooperate with the Russian Orthodox Church. And then, of course, it gets shut down with the rise of Putin. How is this university doing today? How are other Christian universities doing in the former Soviet Union? We have Ukrainian Catholic University, which is actually thriving right now. So John's going to share, the story of the opening of Christian colleges in the former Soviet Union. And then we're going to be joined by attorney Rob Muse from the American Freedom Law Center, getting an overview on some of the most important cases that they've been working with and how the outcomes of these cases. So all that and more coming up on today's Cresta in the Afternoon. But first, let's get to the headlines.
Thanks, Al. Good afternoon, everyone. This is your Ave Maria Radio News for Friday, October 11th. It's the Feast of John the 23rd. Today's news is brought to you by the Ave Maria Family of Funds at AveMariaFunds.com. The U.S. is setting the stage for severe sanctions against Turkey. Talking with reporters at the White House, Treasury Secretary Steve Mnuchin said President Trump is authorizing new sanctioning authority after Turkey started moving against Kurdish forces in northern Syria.
These are very powerful sanctions. We hope we don't have to use them, but we can shut down the Turkish economy if we need to.
That happened after Trump announced plans to withdraw U.S. troops from the war-torn region. Mnuchin says sanctions could be very powerful. Some members of Congress are also preparing legislation to sanction Turkey, a U.S. ally and a member of NATO. Newsweek is reporting that U.S. special forces were caught up in a Turkish shelling of Kurdish positions in northern Syria. The news magazine saying a senior Pentagon official saying that special forces were operating the Kurdish city of Kobani when they fell under artillery fire. The official said they did not know how many personnel were there, but said it was likely between 15 and 100 troops. The official went on to say that Turkish officials should know where the U.S. positions are down to the grid. A federal judge in Texas says President Trump is violating the law by diverting Defense Department funds to help build his border wall. NBC's Pete Williams has the latest.
As it stands right now, it doesn't change anything, but the judge has made it very clear that he thinks what the president did here is illegal, and he intends to stop it once he sees how the parties want to do that.
The judge essentially ruled that Trump is using money that Congress didn't authorize. And the Social Security Administration is lowering the cost of living adjustment for 2020. The agency announced a 1.6% adjustment, which will provide an extra $23 per month on average to Social Security recipients. I'm Steve Clark, Ave Maria Radio News.
Good afternoon. I'm Al Cresta. There are many people, at least we hear that there are many people who have, looking upon the abuse crisis within the Catholic Church, have decided to stay away or not join at all. And this problem is going to be facing not only Catholics, but it's going to be facing Southern Baptists and other groups as they begin to take more seriously the complaints of victims of child sexual abuse, not only within religious institutions, but in public school education and other places. What's interesting about this is that leaving a faith tradition or leaving a church, leaving a community that is a consistent practitioner of religion may not be good for your health. With me right now is Dr. Gregory Popcheck, director of the Pastoral Solutions Institute, a Catholic telecounseling practice that provides marriage and mental health counseling services to Catholics worldwide. He and his wife, Lisa, have authored more than 20 books on relationships and spirituality. And you can hear Dr. Greg and Lisa each weekday at 10 a.m. Eastern Time on the radio program More to Life, produced at Ave Maria Radio and carried by the EWTN Radio Network. Greg, good to have you back.
Terrific to be here, Al. Thank you.
So this is a serious study that was done at Harvard.
Yes.
Okay. What do they mean by religion to begin with?
Well, religion in terms of like a faith community, actually regular church attendance is pretty much what they were talking about. And it was published in the American Journal of Epidemiology, which is a journal, of course, that looks at public health issues.
Right.
So this was exploring the public health benefits of regular religious attendance and involvement.
Okay. And the first question that comes up is always, are people who are happier those who attend religious services more often, or do religious services actually have a causal effect on happiness?
It actually looks like there is a causal effect, that attendance on religious services, religious involvement, does actually cause positive benefits.
Mm-hmm.
This study was actually a longitudinal study and based on several different previous studies with sample sizes in the 6,000 to 8,000 participant range.
Okay.
And it was done over 14 years, from 1999 through 2013.
Wow.
So it was a significant study. And what they did find was that kids who were raised in religious or religious households were better protected in general from things like depression, drugs, and risky sexual behavior. That those who attended religious services regularly were about 12% less likely to have high depressive symptoms and 33% less likely to use illicit drugs. Those who prayed or meditated frequently were 30% less likely to start having sex at a young age, 40% less likely to have an STD. And children with a religious upbringing were more likely to have higher levels of happiness, a sense of purpose,
yeah,
be more pro-social in terms of volunteering and forgiving others. So religion has a lot of positive benefits on both physical, both mental and physical health, surprisingly.
Yeah. Now, do they know what the causal factors are? What is it about attendance at religious services?
Yeah, and of course we can't measure grace, right?
Right.
And so as Christians, we believe that grace has something to do with that,
sure,
a lot to do with that.
Yeah.
But from a purely human side of things, there are several factors. So one is aspirational, the idea that religion reminds us that we're meant for more, so we strive for more. I think it's very easy for all of us to just sort of look in the mirror and say, well, that's all there is, right? But when we go to church, we're reminded that God has more for us, that he wants us to be better. He's giving us the grace to be better. And even if we don't feel like we have the power to make it on our own, grace builds on that nature and gives us the capacity to strive for more. So that's number one, having that sort of aspirational perspective. Another really important sociological factor is just the community of support. Having other people who believe as you do and who are trying to live as you want to live and inspire and support and encourage and sometimes challenge you to be that person. Having those resources to turn to when you're struggling or when you need that support is just tremendously helpful and beneficial. And you know, others will make the argument that, well, you don't need church for that. And technically that's true. The problem is that unless you've got a body of belief to join around or a body of experiences and rituals to join around, people tend to not just randomly form communities. of support. And church does a better job of creating these communities of support that could technically be created in any other way, but just realistically aren't.
That's right. That's right. Yeah, there needs to be some kind of content, some logos or some belief that people gather around. They don't just gather around for the purpose of gathering around.
That's right. And then the rituals, another thing that's really powerful, this is a different study, but Barbara Feese is a psychologist at the University of Illinois, and she is past president of the Society for Family Psychology. She wrote a book called Family Rituals and Routines through Yale University Press a few years ago, where she looked at about 50 years of research on the power of rituals to benefit mental and physical health. And this is something, again, that the churches do better than almost anybody else, creating rituals that allow us to bond together. And the thing about rituals is they're shared, repeated experiences that convey meaning and values, right?
Yep.
And so when people participate in rituals, it gives us a sense of belonging that transcends even reason and emotion. Rituals are why you want to go be back with your family at the holidays, even if you can't stand your family at the holidays. You know, I've participated in these things, and it makes me want to go back. There's a sort of visceral longing to be part of this group and that has shared these experiences with me. Religion creates those rituals and routines that bonds us together with other people and creates that sense of community that makes us feel like we belong, even sometimes when we struggle with the beliefs of a particular church.
Yeah. In fact, in doing work with Catholics or former Catholics who have been alienated from the church through a variety of reasons, something I've noticed time and again is that they often find themselves attracted to the Catholic Church. And in a sense, wanting to come back. And the Eucharist is actually, again, before they even deal with the dogmas surrounding the Eucharist, they want to, they feel like they're missing something outside the Catholic Church. And, so my point is not to deny grace or to deny the theology concerning the Eucharist, but also to point out that oftentimes there's this kind of longing, which is transrational, that those coming back to the Catholic Church have, even before they're entirely convinced they ought to return to the Catholic Church.
Oh, absolutely, yeah. No, it's always more of an emotional and visceral call than an intellectual one for the most part. The other thing, too, is that I get, since this study is specific, or this article in USA Today is specifically responding to people who are saying, the church is all messed up, why should I go every week, what's the point, and I get that on an emotional level. I've experienced those same kinds of feelings myself as I kind of wade through all the stories coming out. But I just sort of on a personal level, I think that what this research really kind of highlights is that it challenges us to step away from a more consumer mindset of church. What do I, what am I getting out of it in terms of, I go there to get something, and have a more relational attitude toward church.
Yes.
Where if you go through a hard time in any relationship, you don't just throw out the relationship, you work through it. And because it benefits you in lots of different ways. I mean, even if I'm not sure I love my wife anymore, I know my life is going to be a whole lot harder if I leave her.
Right.
So I want to work through those things, and the same thing is true about church. That's what this study is really showing, that working through the relationship, that even the difficult relationship that you have with church, benefits you mentally, physically, emotionally, much more than just walking away from the relationship does.
I'm not sure the intellectual history on this, but it is certainly beneficial to have studies like this being done at at important institutions, culturally important institutions, that demonstrate the positive benefits of religious participation. It seems to me it wasn't always that way, that we went through a period of time, I don't know when, if it was the 60s, 70s, where when people heard of a new study about religion, they feared that there was going to be some sort of bashing that took place. When was that?
You know, it's funny. There's always been a tension in psychology about this because going back to the 1850s, actually, there was some really interesting research on the benefits of religious involvement and that kind of work. In the 1950s, Gordon Allport was doing work on intrinsic versus extrinsic faith. You know, Freud was always down on religion, of course, but Jung had a more generous attitude toward it. So there's always been this sort of creative tension, if you will, between, you know, is faith a positive thing or a negative thing? But the more research that's come out, the more we see over and over again intrinsic faith, which is the faith that I go to church because it's personally meaningful for me and I'm trying to seek meaning and relationship as opposed to going to church to, like, you know, sell more insurance policies or something like that.
Yeah.
Intrinsic faith is always beneficial. Physically, emotionally, spiritually, and relationally. In fact, there's really another interesting study that we don't have time to get into today, but maybe we can make this a topic for a future segment. It was just an article in Newsweek just last week that was talking about how a county in Florida reduced divorce rates by 30% because this organization called the Philanthropy Roundtable instituted a research project that got people going to church. And by getting people to go to church, what they did was they set up these sort of targeted marketing campaigns around churches targeted people within a 5-mile radius of the church to try to increase church involvement. And they studied the impact on religion, on relationship.
Yeah.
And they decreased divorce rates by 30% in Duval County, Florida.
That's starting to sound activistic. I mean, my word. So we'll have to definitely talk about that study. So that was in Newsweek just last 2 weeks ago.
Yeah.
I'll get a hold of it.
July 26th.
Okay, that's amazing.
It is.
Let me ask one last question for you, Greg.
Sure.
You work with many patients and have worked with many patients over the years. In your own personal experience, does this study ring true?
Yeah, absolutely it does. Because, you know, again, I work with almost an exclusively religious population. So you know, it wouldn't be fair to say that people of faith never get depressed or never have anxiety problems or never have relationship problems. But what I will say, having worked both with a more secular population and with my now, you know, religious group, the people of faith tend to be more resistant to emotional and relational problems in the first place and tend to bounce back from them more readily than others.
Okay. Greg, thanks so much. We'll talk again.
Pleasure, Al. Thank you.
Dr. Gregory Popcheck, Director of the Pastoral Solutions Institute. I'm Al Cresta.
How do we listen to God? Contrary to popular opinion that God only speaks to the privileged few, the Catholic Catechism tells us he communicates to all of us through our conscience. On our hearts, in our most secret core, God has inscribed the moral law. This law calls man to live and to do what is good and avoid evil. In the aloneness of the sanctuary that is our conscience, our Creator's voice echoes in our depths. When he listens to his conscience, says the Catechism, the prudent man can hear God speaking. Conscience is a judgment of reason whereby the human person recognizes the moral quality of a concrete act about to be performed, is already performing, or has already been performed. John Henry Cardinal Newman defined conscience as the law of the mind whereby God speaks to us behind a veil. This is Peggy Stanton, and this has been the Order of Malta's Minute with the Catechism.
It's time for Family Man with Dr. Gregory Popcheck.
Stress is contagious, even for toddlers. A new study by the University of Cambridge found that even after controlling for temperament, the more stressed moms and dads felt, the more their toddlers tended to be clingy, tantruming, whiny, and defiant. In general, kids are terrific emotional barometers. Little ones especially are always taking their emotional cues from us, even when we think we're keeping it to ourselves. Parents' stress plays out in our facial expressions, our posture, our attitudes, and our ability to pay attention, all things our kids attend to closely. When our kids notice us feeling stressed, it makes them feel unsafe and causes them to act out. If your little one seems off, a good first step is asking yourself how you're managing your own stress level. An ounce of self-care can sometimes be worth a pound of discipline. I'm Dr. Greg Popcheck, but you can call me Family Man.
To discover more ways faith can enrich your life, visit CatholicCounselors.com.
Check out EWTN's official YouTube channel.
Just follow the link on our homepage at EWTN.com or go to YouTube.com/EWTN.
Watch EWTN's live shows or today's homily from the Daily Mass.
Click the upload button to see our most recent clips.
You can also find all of EWTN YouTube content by clicking the playlist button.
It's all on the official EWTN YouTube channel at YouTube.com/EWTN.
Visit today.
Cresta in the Afternoon is underwritten by the following nonprofit organization, Real Estate for Life. Buying or selling your home or business property? Real Estate for Life can connect you to one of 900 pro-life real estate agents around the world. When Real Estate for Life receives a referral fee, they donate 80% of the referral check to Ave Maria Radio and Students for Life. More information at realestateforlife.org or 877-LIFE-US1. That's realestateforlife.org.
This program is brought to you in part by the nonprofit St. Paul Street Evangelization. Pope Francis reminds us that it does not take a specialized degree in theology to become a great evangelist. We're all called to evangelize. Think about the woman at the well. After she encountered Jesus, she immediately went into the city and invited others to meet him as she had. You and I can go out now and do the same. And St. Paul Street Evangelization can help. Get involved today by contacting us at streetevangelization.com.
Hi, I'm Al Cresta. The Catholic faith has enemies. We're Catholics. We have enemies. They are a danger to the faith. And yet we're called to defend the faith, to instruct the ignorant, and to love our enemies. These enemies abuse divine revelation. They abuse science and religion. They abuse our history and our past. They abuse power and wealth. We have to learn how to deal with our enemies by picking up a copy of my book, Dangers to the Faith. You can find it online at AveMariaRadio.net. And good afternoon. I'm Al Cresta. Thanking you for joining me. We're going to take a look at this week of the first week of the Amazonian Synod. With me is Dr. Matthew Bunsen, executive editor of EWTN News. And Matthew, good to have you here. Thank you.
Good to be with you, and greetings again from Rome.
Yeah, tell me, the Synod's week is wrapping up. Are they working over the weekend?
Yes, definitely. Well, the Synod itself will continue through the weekend, and they have, so we'll talk a little bit more about that. The big focus now is shifting over to the major Sunday event, which is the canonization of John Henry Newman and four other saints, who I think at times are somewhat underappreciated, mm-hmm. Four remarkable women, and so as you can imagine, the British are piling into the city, as well as the oratorians. And so I think all of us are looking forward to something of a respite after this first week with the canonization.
Yeah. Well, Matthew, talk to me about the week at the Synod. Are there some issues that dominated?
Well, Pope Francis, at the very start of the Synod, made the observation that there's always a Synod on the inside and a Synod on the outside. And he had hoped that that wouldn't happen again, as often does take place at synods. But I would imagine that sort of defying his expectations, it has happened again, just in this sense, that we have a pretty good idea of what they're discussing in the synod halls. But outside the synod halls, there's also a lot of focus on sort of pressure and trying to guide how the public at large sees these deliberations and discussions. So times have intersected. At other times, I think there really is this perception of a synod on the inside and a synod on the outside.
Okay. So you've got two different realms of discourse here. What is the synod on the inside talking about?
Well, we know that the synod on the inside has looked at a variety of topics. The two most hot-button, most controversial, of course, are and will remain the possibility, or at least a proposal, for the ordination of married men, the so-called viri probati, or tested men, to try to provide pastoral care in the far-flung regions of the Amazon, with what many fear would be universal implications, ramifications, if we do that. The other is trying to find, at least in some of the proposals, some kind of ordained ministry or formal ministry for women that, as we have been talking now for almost 2 years, is fraught not just with landmines, but with nuclear bombs in terms of theological risk, and really contradicting what the church has always taught and what Pope Francis himself has described as a closed door. On the outside of the Synod, that is almost the exclusive focus for a lot of certainly secular media. I've done a lot of secular radio this week, and one of the things that keeps recurring at the very start of the interview is, so is the Catholic Church finally going to ordain married men or allow priests to marry? That's the starting point. And then there are the ecological issues, there are the questions of evangelization, and that's pretty interesting give and take, and a lot of discussions at the Sala Stampa or press offices, press conferences each day.
My guess is that this question of the ordination of women might be the ambition of certain Catholic clerics who are heavily influenced by Europe and North America. But I cannot imagine that this is going to dominate the document, the final document that they come up with, or the material that they give to the Pope. I don't see it.
I would agree with that.
Yeah.
This has been one proposal out of a host, or anyone who tries to slog their way through the instrumental laboratory of the blueprint for the Synod. It is a massive document. Would have found scant reference, basically only two places in the document where those proposals were advanced. You know that at least one bishop or one spokesperson, one person speaking in their intervention, raised the prospect of the very pro body, and at least one person, we don't know how many or what sort of consensus there is, raised the prospect of sort of formal ministry for women. What you also know, however, is that there was pushback in the Synod in the intervention.
Right.
On the one hand, there were arguments that we have to have far more creative responses than simply embracing some panacea of ordaining tested men, so-called.
Yeah.
And certainly there was a strong rebuttal, at least from what we're hearing, regarding the formal ministry for women. In reply, in fact, there were statements made that, no, we have to focus on lay ministry. For women who are very actively and significantly involved in the life of the Amazon, in particular Catholic life there.
Mm-hmm.
So
mm-hmm.
We have to stay within the boundaries of what's in the church.
Right. There was a bishop who warned that the church cannot sacralize every indigenous thing, nor can we satanize it. This was a Brazilian bishop, Wilmar Santin. He was talking about this on Thursday at the press conference. And is that what we're seeing? That's a fairly commonsensical remark, that when you're approaching a given culture, given society, you don't go there to baptize everything they do, and you don't go there to exercise everything they do.
That's right.
So,
it's appropriate enculturation. And how we evangelize respects the dignity of the human person, but also understands the context and the realities for how we're going to go about doing evangelization properly. And if we want to see historical examples, all we have to do is look to Pope Gregory the First the Great, who cast his eyes to the north and saw the vast stretches of Germania and beyond, and sent out missionaries to evangelize, and often at great risk of their lives and their safety, and yet they came to understand Germanic culture. And so I'm not using the term barbarian culture.
Right.
They understood what they were facing, and they respected the people. Why? Because we love them in exactly the same way that when the missionaries arrived in the New World, the Jesuits especially sent the best and the brightest they had. Why? Because that's what we do, out of love and care for the souls of the people we're trying to evangelize. So I think it was, as you noted, a somewhat commonsensical comment.
Yeah. Well, I'm hoping that that there'll be that kind of common sense limits on the speculations about these, these issues about the ordination of women and abolishing celibacy for the reasons that they're bringing up here. I think that we've got, if you're going to lift get rid of the discipline of celibacy, you're going to do it for reasons other than that we need a few more priests. in the Amazonian regions. So I would think that's going to be a discussion with the larger church.
It's important. Exactly. And why then, if for a matter of such deep significance, would we not avoid the trap of launching down this road of ordaining the very probody, of risking the church's understanding of celibacy and the mandate for clerical celibacy with nothing more than, and I'm not trying to de-emphasize what's happening here, but such a decision really is the purview of a significantly more important type of gathering.
Yeah.
And this would not be the setting for that.
Yeah. What's the attitude like among the bishops there? Are they upbeat? Are they full of anxiety? Are they having a good time? What's the general spirit of things?
There seems actually to be a genuine willingness and eagerness to listen, to hear the testimony and the experiences of those who are from the Amazonian region.
Mm-hmm.
And in much the same way that we have seen with previous synods, especially the regional ones, I go back to the ones for Africa, the ones for the Middle East, where only those who have the experience of living there can fully help us as a church to understand the reality there. Now, we have to be careful, because if there's spin accompanying that, what we're hearing outside the Synod Hall may be very different in terms, again, what they're hearing on the inside. And so we have to really take with a grain of salt many of the press accounts we're seeing of what happened here, and just wait into the next week as we have the small language groups, the so-called Turkish and Minori, largely Spanish and Portuguese, that will be now grappling with these propositions and these ideas that we're advancing the interventions.
Okay. We have, again, the canonization of John Henry Newman this weekend. I want to make sure we spend some time there. But there are also four women that you mentioned who will be being canonized as well. We probably don't know a whole lot about them. At least I don't. So why don't you tell us about them?
No. Well, very briefly, I'll focus on just one or two, since I know time is always of an essence here. Marguerite Bays was a Swiss mystic who, in her lifetime, really embraced the cross of our Lord. And another mystic, Mother Thresia, from India, who always longed to be able to have the life of a hermit.
Huh.
And for her, it was not to be. Like many of the great saints and mystics in history, she was sent out. She was asked to do something that she probably didn't really want to do, and that was to go out into the world to form a congregation and to care for the sick. And she did that, but she was always a mystic at heart. And those two mystics, I think, we have a lot to learn from. And then there's Giuseppini Bernini, who was a brilliant nun who, again, was caring for the sick and those who were forgotten by society. And then we have Irma Dulces, who is from Brazil, who stands, I think, as almost the antithesis of liberation theology and was ardently opposed to it in her time, and she's a contemporary of ours. So this is somebody who understood that the so-called preferential option for the poor does not mean that we have to embrace liberation theology and so many of the Marxist ideals that at times, in the radical expression of it, undergirds what's being proposed.
Is there, during these canonizations, is there public materials being passed out to help educate those who are attending, or is it already assumed that those attending have sufficient background on these men and women who are being canonized?
Yeah, well, it's one fun thing to attend a canonization are the little booklets that are always handed out. And they're very tidy, and they're tiny, and yet they work really well. They're packed full of information about the whole of the liturgy. And they're a guide in multiple languages for anyone who's attending. And included in those, especially for canonizations like this, are fairly detailed biographies of the saints. Now, I'm going to guess, just for the sake of not being too polarizing, that my comments regarding liberation theology will probably not make it into the biography of the Pavilion.
Right, right. Matthew, hold it there. We'll be back in just a minute here.
Beth, why is our health insurance so expensive? Our premium and deductible are so high. Plus, I don't want my family to support a company that doesn't share our values.
Kim, there is another option. Check out CMF Curo. It's an affordable Catholic healthcare ministry where members share their medical costs in community, and it's pro-life. We joined last year and have saved thousands, all without compromising our values. Just go to MyCatholicHealthcare.com.
CMF Curo sounds exactly like what our family needs.
Yeah, that's MyCatholicHealthcare.com.
Underwritten in part by this not-for-profit.
Have you heard about Lord Teach Me to Pray? Lord Teach Me to Pray is a prayer series based upon the spiritual exercises of St. Ignatius of Loyola.
Training retreats will be held this summer and fall in various parts of the country. Go to LordTeachMeToPray.com to find a training retreat near you. In this exciting time of the new evangelization, the best way we can share the faith is by strengthening our own relationship with the Lord Jesus.
Lord Teach Me to Pray is sure to be transformative.
Go to LordTeachMeToPray.com and click on Facilitator Training Retreats.
The EWTN home video highlight for October is the EWTN Family Celebration from Denver, Colorado. John Ed Williams, Father Mitch Pacwa, Dr. David Anders, Father Innocent, Father Augustino, and Father Angelus show us how faith can move mountains. Order your DVD at EWTNRC.com 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, or call 1-800-854-6316.
If you believe in the power of prayer, Ave Maria Radio invites you to look at their website to submit a prayer request at AveMariaRadio.net. Your prayer requests are shared with hundreds at the Dominican Sisters of Mary, Mother of the Eucharist, the Servants of God's Love, the Monastery of the Blessed Sacrament Cloistered Nuns, the Family of Faith Apostolate, and the staff of Ave Maria Radio. Just go to AveMariaRadio.net and click on the Community tab to submit your prayer request today.
What's stopping you from becoming a Catholic?
Why can't women become priests?
I don't understand why I have to earn salvation.
How is it possible that God created everything?
Why do I need to confess my sins to
a
priest?
Why is the Catholic Church so unwilling to
The Catholic Church is too rich.
Catholics worship Mary and are committed.
As far as I'm concerned, all religions are equal.
You are called to communion with Dr. David Anders. Tonight, 11 p.m. Eastern, on the EWTN Global Catholic Radio Network.
In July of this year, the California Court of Appeals handed down an important decision in a case we were litigating on behalf of our pro-life clients. The three-judge panel unanimously ruled in our favor, holding that a restriction on pro-life signs because they were grisly or gruesome violated the liberty of speech clause of the California Constitution. At issue was whether the Irvine Company's speech restriction prohibiting grisly and gruesome imagery as applied to restrict our clients' abortion-related imagery violates the free speech provision of the California Constitution. Unlike the First Amendment, which only applies to state action, under the California Constitution, large shopping malls are considered public forums for free speech, and private entities, such as the Irvine Company, may be liable for violating California's liberty of speech clause. The trial court upheld the Irvine Company's speech restriction, but the California Court of Appeals reversed, holding that the challenge restriction is content-based and does not survive strict scrutiny review. This is a huge and important victory for the right to free speech. Indeed, there is hope for the free speech rights of conservatives when a California appellate court upholds the right of a pro-life organization to display abortion imagery in large private shopping centers under the California Constitution. I'm Robert Buse, co-founder and senior counsel for the American Freedom Law Center, bringing you this Faith and Freedom Minute. You can learn more about the American Freedom Law Center and its fight for your faith and freedom by visiting our website and liking us on Facebook.
And a good afternoon to you. I'm Al Cresta. With me is Dr. Matthew Bunsen. He's in Rome at the Amazonian Synod. And this weekend, of course, we also have the canonization of John Henry Newman. And for women who are not, you know, familiar to many of us, Mother Miriam Tricia, Marguerite Bays, Mother Giuseppini Vanini, and Sister Dolce Lopez. And we were discussing the different ministries of these particular women. Do you know, Matthew, why this is the time for these women to be recognized?
Well, I say this with absolute sincerity, that the timing is really up to God.
Yeah.
And I just interviewed Melissa Villalobos, who was the miracolata for the second miracle of John Henry Newman. And she was actually somebody who first became aware of John Henry Newman because of EWTN, in much the same way that the miracle that was connected to John Henry Newman that led to his beatification was also somebody with a spinal injury who was became familiar with him through EWTN. This isn't a shameless plug for my network, but what I'm getting at is that there is a timing to things that is always, to me, fascinating to watch and to appreciate. And the miracles that were approved earlier this year for these new saints, including John Henry Newman, come at exactly the time, I think, when God is trying to teach us a lesson in these new saints. So in John Henry Newman, we have a theologian, an apologist, a brilliant mind, but somebody also who understood what actual conscience means and what it means to form your conscience properly, and then to be able to defend the faith in a hostile environment. These four women, I think, are a reminder to us that in an age of feminism, in an age in which we are given so many different role models of women who really defy what is for the common good and motherhood and holiness, all four help us to understand the power of the cross, the importance of holiness, and how we are supposed to lead our lives, not just as men and women, but as faithful followers of Jesus Christ.
How's the secular press been covering this, as you look through the European papers?
Yeah, most of the focus, you can imagine, is on John Henry Newman. This is a big event for English Catholicism, and in many ways for academics and theologians and those who are concerned about Catholic identity on university campuses and just among the Catholic academics and theologians. There's also been quite a bit of focus on Irma Lopez, as I was mentioning, Irma Dolce, because she has been cast as, in some quarters, as a kind of social justice warrior, as somebody who cares for the poor, as though there's a separation between fidelity to the teachings of the church and a love for the poor. Mother Teresa, I think, is a perfect example of how, with, at times, an effort to disconnect the two, and yet in her life, she so brilliantly made sure that could never happen.
Yes, yes, that's right. And she was very big on making sure that there, without the Eucharist, there would have been no missionaries of charity. There would have been no Nobel Peace Prize. There would have been no international recognition. It all flowed from her commitment to the Eucharist.
That's right. And we see in those four women especially the cross of our Lord, that all of them in one way or another endured deep suffering. We have in, I think it was Marguerite Bayes, who at the age of 35 suffered from a cancer that was healed miraculously on December 8th, I think it was 1846, which at the very moment that the cure took place was the moment of the proclamation of the dogma of the Immaculate Conception by Pope Blessed Pius IX.
Mm-hmm.
So these are the sorts of stories, I think, that these saints introduce us to, expose us to, and invite us then to think about how providence is always here with us.
Has Pope Francis been very visible this week?
He's been at most of the sessions, as far as I'm aware, at his Angelus. He was reflecting on the importance of faith and other things. It is my understanding that he has been attending all of the sessions,
okay,
or at least most of them. And this is something, as we have seen with previous synods, that he is committed firmly to his vision for the Synod of Bishops and its role of so-called synodality, the synodal path. And so he's very much present mentally, sort of spiritually, and I think this is something that is important to him. And I understand the significance that he attaches to the Pan-Amazonian Synod, because as one of the heads of CELAM, which is a Latin American Bishops Conference, back when he was Jorge Mario Bergoglio, the Archbishop of Buenos Aires, he played a major role in that episcopal conference and helped draft one of its most significant documents called Opera Sida, and I know you're familiar with it,
yes,
Al.
Yes,
yes. We took a survey of where Latin America is in the life of the church.
Yeah, I mean, the document, the Apostolic document, is really a very strong document on missionary discipleship. And a lot of times when people think of South American bishops, they tend to think of social justice issues. And that's, you know, there's certainly truth to that. But at least this particular document was very strong on missionary discipleship. And, you know, again, people wondering, that was a big emphasis of Pope Francis in the very beginning of his pontificate with publication of Joy of the Gospel 8 months into his pontificate. And there are some people who are wondering, is he kind of moved on? Was that just something he wanted to make sure his first few years echoed because it established continuity with Pope John Paul II and Pope Benedict? And now he's moved on to having another set of priorities. Do you have any impressions that you can give us about this?
Yeah, I, in a way, I think one of the approaches to this is that and it's perhaps a poor analogy, but I think allow me to torture it a little bit.
Sure.
With Pope St. John Paul II, we had in his very first encyclical, the Redemptor Hominis, what some people have forgotten was almost a blueprint for his pontificate.
That's right, that's right.
And that was that man is a mystery to himself unless seen through Christ. And that led to, then, his throw open door, wide the doors to Christ, just be not afraid. But it also positioned him beautifully for the kind of theological anthropology that followed, that included, of course, the theology of the body, and his defense of the human person at the end of the 20th century. I think for Pope Francis, Evangelii Gaudium remains kind of the blueprint for his pontificate.
Okay.
With his themes on mercy, of joy, this proclamation of going out, that the church cannot be closed in on herself. And we see this as a recurring theme in all of his encyclicals, including Laudato Si, which is itself the pillar for this synod, but also for, I think, the way he has conducted synods. There's always this recourse to going out into the world, and we're seeing exactly that here. Now, how we do that is another question, and I think there's always going to be a bit of controversy surrounding how this is going to be implemented and how some, at least, choose to interpret Francis's approach.
Yeah. Yeah, well, how is he handling this German synod that's expected at the beginning of Advent, and which seems to have been undertaken without his direct blessing?
Yes, well, one of the architects for that so-called synodal path on the part of the German bishops, and even the German bishops don't necessarily agree as to what all of that means, is Cardinal Reinhard Marx, the Archbishop of Munich and Freising, and also the president of the German Episcopal Conference. He's here. He has spoken. He focused mostly on industrial themes. But sure enough, then, we know that the German church has played a significant role financially and in terms of just material support for this synod, just as it does for the work of the church across whole swaths of Latin America, in particular, in Brazil. So the fact that the Germans are so heavily involved and heavily invested in the church in South America raises a variety of questions as to their influence here in this synod. So that, I think, is going to be one of those open questions that we're going to discover more, I think, in the coming weeks.
Given that there's so much talk about, with the German synod, for instance, opening up communion to non-Catholics in some limited fashion, and other issues which push against standard orthodoxy, do you think that this, with these issues, when they come up, well, they're apt to be rejected? I do not see that Pope Francis is going to somehow open up communion in any significant way to non-Catholics. There may be certain circumstances in which it'd be permitted, but it would have to be pretty clearly defined. Yes. Are we going through a period now where these questions are being allowed to be restated again, simply for the purpose of us getting them straight again.
Well, I hope so. Let's put it that way. Pope Francis sent a letter to the German church a couple of months ago, to the German church, so let's stress that, exhorting them, calling on them to walk the synodal path in much greater fidelity to what he has laid out as a synodal path, and which is very different, I think, from that which has been crafted and set into motion by the majority of the bishops of the German Episcopal Conference. And it was worth noting that Cardinal Rainer Wilke of Cologne actually attempted to introduce a resolution in this German synodal process to embrace something that was much more close to Pope Francis's vision of the synodal way than the one being advocated by the Germans. And unfortunately, Cardinal Wilke had few supporters within the German Bishops' Conference.
Okay. So do the German bishops somehow see themselves as leaders in this, you know, fashioning of a more synodal Catholicism?
Well, I, if you were to talk with Cardinal Marx, I'm sure that he would argue that no, they are standing quite within continuity in the teachings of the Church. Others, I'm sure, would very strongly disagree with that. I think Cardinal Marx has been pushing ahead deliberately and very forcefully with his vision, and apparently the vision of a number of the German bishops, that this is necessary to try to resurrect the Church and Christian life in Germany at a time when it is ebbing away.
What makes him
every possible way that we can account?
What makes him think that this accommodation of the teaching of the Church to basically almost democratic vote from the German people? Why does he think all of a sudden people are going to become going back to church? I don't get it, because once you tell me that the Church has caught up with me, I don't need the Church anymore. I'm the one who's in leadership here. The Church is catching up with me. Why does anybody want to go get caught up with the Church?
Well, I mean, it's recrafting and reshaping the Church in the image that I want, rather than trying to reshape myself in the image that Christ wants, that God wants. We were just talking about these great saints who were obedient to what God wanted in their lives, often doing things that they knew were going to be incredibly difficult and painful.
And if
they want to know what the end result of a lot of this is going to be, they already have it. And that's in the mainline Protestant churches of Germany, which are almost extinct.
I agree. Matthew, thank you so much. We'll talk soon. Thank you.
God bless.
Dr. Matthew Bunsen in Rome, filling us in on the Synod, the Amazonian Synod.
Christ is the answer, with Father John Ricardo.
John 6, verses 48 to 58. Jesus says, "I am the bread of life. Your fathers ate the manna in the wilderness, and they died. This is the bread," meaning me. "This is the bread which comes down from heaven, that a man may eat of it and never die. I am the living bread which came down from heaven. If anyone eats of this bread, he will live forever. And the bread which I shall give for the life of the world is my flesh." At which the Jews disputed among themselves, saying, "How can this man give us his flesh to eat?" They're scandalized by this. How is it that we're not? How is it that we just hear this and go, "Oh yeah, I know that passage"? They're just outraged and at least perplexed. Sane people, inspired teachers, wise men, prophets don't say things like this.
Dr. Ray Guarendi.
There's a simple step to raising a more grateful child. I used to say, easy, eliminate half of their material possessions. I don't say that anymore. That's ridiculous. I say 75%. They don't even miss 50. 22 stuffed animals, you go down to 11. Not exactly a hardship. Simple step to raising a more grateful child. Don't be so free with the material stuff. Research has shown more generous people, by and large, have less. You give a child less, he's more willing to share it. He also is more able to occupy himself with things like boxes and dirt balls and rocks, worms, stuff that doesn't cost a whole lot of anything.
And good afternoon. I'm Al Cresta, thanking you for being here this first hour. We got more coming up. Let me remind you that whatever we discuss on this program is available in deeper form by going to AveMariaRadio.net. Go to the Cresta Guest Archives, where we'll have follow-up information on all of our topics. Now, let me tell you what's coming up in the next hour. Dr. John Birnbaum led a group of Christians in the field of higher education, to go into the former Soviet Union. This is after the collapse of Soviet-style communism. This is after the Cold War is over. And to try to build a Christian university, which would not only maintain the faith of the Christians, but it would help train them in both business and social work to help build a new Russia. Now, you would think this would get great support from Russian leadership. Well, we're going to find out what happened and what it accomplished and what it failed to do. So that's coming up. And we're going to take time in the next hour or two to talk with attorney Rob Muse from the American Freedom Law Center. Religious liberty issues, free speech issues are going to have to be litigated in the future. We're going to have to push back. And Rob is one of the people on the front line doing that very thing. He shares a story with us. Coming up next hour, I'm Al Cresta.
This hour of Cresta in the Afternoon is co-produced by Ave Maria Radio and EWTN Radio and carried across the EWTN Global Catholic Radio Network.
Cresta in the Afternoon is a co-production of Ave Maria Radio and EWTN Radio and carried across the EWTN Global Catholic Radio Network.
With the New York Times in one hand and the Catechism of the Catholic Church in the other, Al Cresta is ready for conversations of consequence.
America is as divided as it has been in 150 years.
Politics is symptomatic of the culture.
They don't have a personal relationship with Christ.
We've been sacramentalized, but not evangelized.
Why should Washington listen to us when our own house is in disarray?
The church's greatest riches are her people.
Share the contagious joy of being a friend of Christ.
Story after story after story of people who have had inexplicable healings.
Broadcasting from the studios of Ave Maria Radio in Ann Arbor, Michigan, and taking a closer Catholic look at current events, issues, and ideas. This is Cresta in the Afternoon.
That's beautifully said, Al.
Thanks for your voice for liberty.
It's like a homecoming each time on your program.
Clear to me that you've thought these things through at a deep level.
Let's build the church, and then we'll bless the nations. And a good afternoon to you. I'm Al Cresta, thanking you for joining us. Another hour here to talk about the things that matter most. There's a marvelous story of Christian missions told after the collapse of Soviet communism. After the Berlin Wall fell, there were a group of Christian colleges from the United States who seized the opportunity to begin, you know, making some faculty and student exchanges. These are things that they were unable to do when the Soviet Union still wielded authority. So they began these faculty and student exchanges with universities inside the Soviet Union. Among the leaders was John Birnbaum, who during a 1990 visit to Russia accepted an invitation to build a new faith-based university in Moscow. You know, this is where the former center of atheistic communism. And so this university was built. We're going to talk about how it was built. We're going to talk about the impact it had on students and the impact it had on the emerging new Russia. And what's its status today? So that's coming up in this next hour of Crest in the Afternoon. And then we're going to be joined by attorney Rob Muse, co-founder of the American Freedom Law Center. This organization is really on the front lines protecting our right to free speech, our right to free association, our right to religious liberty. And unfortunately, in an increasingly secularized, highly centralized government, religious issues tend to be regarded as matters of private interest. Your faith, in the eyes of the government, is kind of like your hobby. it's fine that you have it. It keeps you doing things that you think are important. But basically, it gets in the way of the objectives of highly centralized federal government. So Rob's organization, the American Freedom Law Center, is fighting back. And he's going to tell us in what particular arenas they've been fighting recently. But first, let's get to the headlines.
Thanks, Al. Good afternoon, everyone. This is your Ave Maria Radio News for Friday, October 11th. It's the Feast of John the 23rd. Today's news is brought to you by the Ave Maria Family of Funds at AveMariaFunds.com. Defense Secretary Mark Esper says the U.S. is greatly disappointed that Turkey is moving against Kurds in northern Syria.
I spoke with Turkish Defense Minister Akar yesterday to express our strong opposition to Turkey's actions and reiterated the damage this is doing to our bilateral relationship.
Talking with reporters at the Pentagon, Esper insisted that the U.S. is not abandoning Kurdish forces. Turkey started making moves after President Trump announced plans to remove U.S. troops from northern Syria. The U.S. has been helping the Kurds combat ISIS. The Trump administration and some members of Congress are drafting legislation to sanction Turkey, a U.S. ally and member of NATO. The Syrian Democratic Forces are claiming five ISIS militants have broken out of a prison in Syria after it was bombed by Turkish forces. Reports claim that nine civilians have also been killed in a Turkish military operation and thousands have fled their homes. Democratic presidential hopeful Beto O'Rourke says he would strip churches of tax-exempt status if they don't support same-sex marriage. The issue came up last night at a CNN LGBTQ town hall featuring O'Rourke and other candidates. O'Rourke stated that, quote, there can be no reward, benefit, or tax break for anyone that denies the full human rights and civil rights of every one of us, end quote. Beckett, a religious liberty law firm, responded to the statement, calling it blatantly unconstitutional. Evacuations are ramping up dramatically as deadly wildfires rage in suburban sections of Los Angeles. Fire officials say some 23,000 homes are under mandatory evacuations around the San Fernando Valley, and at least 25 homes have been damaged or destroyed as major wildfires are shutting down miles of busy Southern California freeways. I'm Steve Clark, Ave Maria Radio News.
Good afternoon. I'm Al Cresta. After the Berlin Wall fell, a group of Christian colleges in the United States seized the opportunity to begin strategic faculty and student exchanges with universities within the Soviet Union. Among their leaders was John Birnbaum, who during a 1990 visit to Russia accepted an invitation to build a faith-based university in Moscow, the former center of the atheistic regime. John joins me right now. He's the author of Opening the Red Door, the inside story of Russia's first Christian liberal arts university. He's worked for the U.S. Department of State from 1972 to 1976 and then spent nearly two decades with the Council for Christian Colleges and Universities. John, good to have you here. Thank you.
Well, thank you. It's a real privilege to be with you, Al.
Let's talk a little bit about what those days were like. Europe was going through, or Eastern Europe was going through lots of change. Soviet Union and collapsed, the rise of Russia. I can only imagine that it was fairly traumatic for the citizens of those countries in the Eastern Bloc.
You know, Al, it was an unbelievable experience for me. You know, I'm a historian by training. And I've gotten a doctorate in European and Russian history, but I had no idea that I'd ever have the opportunity to actually go to Russia or the Soviet Union and actually experience it.
Right.
And so when I went there the first time in 1990, it was an unbelievable experience to stand in Red Square and think, what's this boy from Chicago doing in the Kremlin?
Right, right. How, there was so much turmoil at that time. Were people were they afraid of the future?
Well, I would say they were overwhelmed by the chaos and the confusion.
Yeah.
I mean, I think in the initial days of when Gorbachev came to power in 1985, and then started this policy of openness,
right,
Glasnost and Perestroika, that people got excited in the early stages. But when corruption began to come in and the economy imploded it made life very, very difficult for the average person. Mm-hmm. So when I went there for the first time, Alan, and we went through Moscow, we go in the stores, and the shelves were absolutely empty. There was no food.
Wow. Wow.
And people were terribly impoverished. You know, some of your listeners probably are old enough to remember the Great Depression, and some that are younger probably have seen documentaries on it.
Sure.
But just think about this a minute. That depression that the Russians went through in 1990 was twice as large and three times longer than the Great Depression in the United States. So that gives you a little idea what these people went through.
Yeah. Who did you connect with there to talk about bringing Christian education to Russia?
Again, that's a rather amazing story. The man who was the key player here on the Russian side was the Minister of Education, a fellow named Kazantsev, and he was probably in his 70s, and he was so concerned about what was happening to his country, particularly as capitalism came in and it was followed by a lot of corruption.
Mm-hmm.
He met some missionaries, Peter and Anita Dynica, from Slavic Gospel Association.
Sure, they've got a long and great reputation. I remember them,
And, you know, they had been banned from Russia under the Soviet Union.
Yep.
But he met them, and then some students from Wheaton College in Wheaton, Illinois, came to Russia in 1990, and he met these kids, and he said, wow, you know, we want people like that to come here and to bring Jesus with them.
Yeah.
I mean, this is a guy who's not necessarily a person of faith, but when he saw these kids, he said, we have to learn where these kids came from.
Wow.
And so let's start an exchange agreement. That's how the whole thing started.
Okay.
So it really wasn't, Al, it wasn't anything to do with me. I was just helping out the Dynicas.
So the exchange program, how did that eventually lead to the creation of a university?
Well, it was actually, it goes all the way back to my first visit, and it's a day that obviously changed my life and the life of a lot of people. It was our first trip, and on October 26, 1990, at the end of our visit, the Ministry of Education, a new Ministry of Education, came into power under Boris Yeltsin. And he basically said, invited me to his office and then told me, I'm going to democratize these universities. We're going to throw out the Communist Party. We want to have exchange agreements with the West. And then will you come here and build a Christian college? And, Al, I was stunned.
Yeah.
2 years before, if you were a person of faith, you couldn't get into a Soviet university. And now the guy was saying, please come here and build one in Moscow. So it was a Macedonian call on my life.
Yeah, yes, yeah, the, like St. Paul. So that is amazing. And where'd the money come from? I can't imagine that they had a lot of money to shell out.
Well, they had very little, and that's a part of the miraculous part of this story, Al. I mean, when the invitation came to us, of course, you know, I got together with a group of Americans who knew something about Russia, who cared about higher education, and we met together and said, well, what can we do? I mean, what should we do about this request? We have no money.
Yeah.
We have no faculty. We have no students. I mean, how do you do this? But by the grace of God, I mean, we met a number of donors in the United States who cared about Russia and wanted to invest in the country and thought, Christians have suffered so much in that country.
Yeah.
What can we do to help them?
Yeah, yeah.
And that was actually, Al, that was the primary focus of our school in the early days, just to basically educate students of parents who were denied access to higher education. So we said, let's train these kids to be the future leaders of the country by giving them the language skills, the technical training, and the moral and spiritual grounding. So it was a battle. I mean, the whole process took, you know, 5 years to get off the ground.
Mm-hmm.
But eventually, we found some American Christians who basically said, this is a good investment.
Yeah.
And we want to put money into this. So
good.
We decided early on, Al, to keep it a private university.
Yes.
We didn't want American government money, and we didn't want Russian government money.
Okay, good, good. Yeah, that gives you that allows you to keep the faith strong, not have to worry about governmental regulations or governmental mandates interfering with your creative control of the university. What about the Russian Orthodox Church? I remember those years that there was a lot of evangelical activity going on, but there was also conflict at times with the Russian Orthodox groups. And I'm wondering, did you run into that at all?
Yes. I would say at first there was an incredible openness and hospitality on the part of everybody in society, number one, but even church leaders, including the Orthodox Church. So I think at first in 1990, 1991, a religious freedom law was passed. It was probably the most progressive, open law in the country, in the world at that point, basically saying freedom of religion. But increasingly, the Russian Orthodox Church, or at least the conservative elements in the church, were very unhappy with all the Western missionaries that were pouring into the country. So there were repeated efforts to change the law and to restrict the freedom of missionaries. And eventually in 1997, they were able to change that that law and make it much more difficult. But I would say it continued to be an open possibility for us to operate until Putin came to power.
Okay. Okay.
And then gradually we began to lose our freedom. And so it was an open possibility to work together with Catholics and Orthodox and Christians. I mean, we had Protestants, Catholics, and Orthodox students in our school.
Yeah.
And it was such a joy to bring these bright young people together and say, you learn to respect each other.
Yeah, yeah. And that's great.
And to learn from each other.
Yeah, no, that's beautiful. So what happened? What happened with Putin? Was he from the beginning somebody that you anticipated would be a problem?
No, actually, exactly the opposite, Al. When he came to power in 2000, after the last 4 years of Boris Yeltsin, 96 to 2000, were years of chaos in Russia. I mean, he was drunk half the time.
Yeah.
These oligarchs were running the country. He didn't show up to work. I mean, you know, I was robbed on a metro by police officers in 1997.
Oh,
I mean, you know, it was just chaos. So when Putin came to power, it appeared to us that he was going to bring some law and order to the country. And you may remember after September 11, he was the first person to call President Bush.
Yeah. Yeah.
And promised to assist us in our battle against radical Islam.
Mm-hmm.
And so it looked to us like, boy, this is the beginning of a new day.
Yeah.
But it didn't last very long. We talk about Putin 1 and Putin 2.
Okay.
When Putin 2 came back into power, he had become increasingly anti-Western. And the hostility just grew in the country. When we were trying to build our building, the Communist Party came out and the Nationalists came out and broke windows and stormed the place and made it very, very difficult for us. So by 2008, 2009, 2010, it was making life very, very difficult.
Do you know what happened to change Putin's attitude towards Western assistance and Western involvement?
Well, that's a long story, I would say, but I'd say it's a couple things. We know now what we didn't know then, that when he came to power in 2001, 2002, he was committed not to build a democratic government at all. He was committed to build a strong Soviet Russian government that would stand up to the United States. And it would not be pushed around or bullied by the United States. We didn't know that in the early years, but now the documents have all come out about things that he wrote and a number of his colleagues wrote in those very early years. So I think he played a little bit of a game with Western diplomats by trying to sound like he was going to be cooperative and supportive. But from the beginning, I mean, he closed down the media. He was arresting dissidents. You know, he was making things very difficult, but it just got accentuated at the end.
Hold it there, if you would, John. We'll come back and continue the conversation after this break. My guest is John Birnbaum, opening the Red Door, the inside story of Russia's first Christian liberal arts university.
Father Benedict Groeschel.
I love reverence. Wherever I go in the world, I usually go to visit the religious buildings. And no matter what I see reverence, awe. I've been in temples and mosques where I saw more reverence and awe of God than I see in Christian churches, even sometimes in Catholic churches. Oh, yes, let me say it. And when I was a boy, Catholics were much more reverent and respectful in church. You never, ever spoke in church. I was a young priest. A man had a heart attack at the beginning of Mass. I stopped the Mass. We prayed for the man while the police were coming, the ambulance. They removed him from the church. He didn't die. Not one word was spoken. The police officers and the ambulance attendants who came whispered respect. I wish it were true today.
EWTN. Live truth. Live Catholic.
How can we be sure our conscience is guiding us rightly? The Catholic Catechism states that in order to make correct moral judgments, we must have a well-formed conscience, one that is upright, truthful, and formulates its judgments according to reason and conforms them to the true good willed by the wisdom of the Creator. In order to avoid the trap of negative influences and the desire to prefer our own judgments, we must educate our conscience. The Catechism asserts that prudent education teaches virtue and guarantees freedom and engenders peace of heart. What are the ingredients of this educational stew? The Word of God, which we absorb through faith and prayer and an examination of conscience before the Lord's cross. Though our modern world sometimes makes discernment difficult, a well-formed conscience helps us see what is right and choose what is the will of God as expressed in divine law. This is Peggy Stanton, and this has been the Order of Malta's Minute with the Catechism.
Forever they will be venerated and distinguished for heroic virtue. Join the Holy Father as these witnesses to the Christian faithful are raised to the altars, including John Henry Cardinal Newman, live from St. Peter's Square. Holy Mass with canonizations, including John Henry Cardinal Newman, Sunday, October 13th at 3:30 a.m. Eastern, here on EWTN.
Solidarity HealthShare began out of the Christian tradition of neighbor helping neighbor. They're a nonprofit medical cost-sharing ministry in which their members share in each other's eligible medical expenses. Solidarity HealthShare is not insurance, but rather an alternative way to pay for medical costs that adheres to the teachings of the Catholic Church. They'll never share in a medical care that goes against their values and morals, such as abortion, contraception, and sterilization. More information available at SolidarityHealthShare.org or at 844-313-4999.
When the need for senior care arises, home is where the heart is. Visiting Angels provides home care for mom or dad up to 24 hours per day, including personal care, meals, and light housework. You may select your professional caregiver with Visiting Angels. More information at visitingangels.com or at 877-374-LIVE. That's 877-374-LIVE. Visiting Angels, America's choice in senior home care.
Would you get on a plane that doesn't have a pilot? Investing in passive index mutual funds may present the same issue. The Ave Maria Mutual Funds are actively managed by seasoned investment professionals to help you meet your investment goals in a morally responsible way. Ave Maria funds are managed to conform to pro-life and pro-family values. Long-term investors could invest in the no-load Ave Maria Mutual Funds. You can learn more about the Ave Maria Mutual Funds at 866-AVE-MARIA or visit AveMariaFunds.com.
Good afternoon. I'm Al Cresta. With me is John Birnbaum. He received his doctorate, by the way, from the University of Maryland, and as I said earlier, worked for the U.S. Department of State from 1972 to 76, and then spent nearly two decades with the Council for Christian Colleges and Universities in Washington, D.C. We're talking about his involvement in opening Russia's first Christian liberal arts university, and it had such promise, right? I mean, the students, the younger students were enthusiastic. How did they reflect the changing social environment there? Was their youthful idealism able to rise above it?
That's a very interesting question, Al, because that was one thing. I mean, my whole life has been college teaching, so yeah. I was very interested in how the students would handle this. College students during this period of time were called Generation Niet, Generation No, because they were so hostile to what had gone on in their country under Gorbachev and Yeltsin, and then the Soviet Union collapsing, and all of their heroes when they were young, they were told were a bunch of crooks and murderers. Mm. Stalin was a mass murderer. And the generation generally became very cynical, very self-centered. But these Christian young people were exceptions to the rule.
Okay.
The students we had in our school were unbelievable. Not only were they great students, but they had such a love for their country, and they wanted to do things to make it a better place. And so we had a lot of our students went into business, but the other half of our student body went into social work.
Yeah.
And they were working with disabled children and orphan kids and street kids, and they were really trying to make a difference. So it was so exciting to see our students. I mean, again, I'll give you one example of that real quickly.
Sure.
When Christmas vacation would come around, these kids would volunteer to work with different medical teams that would take doctors and nurses out into the provinces where they weren't getting any medical assistance. And our kids would go along and be interpreters and, you know, carry boxes and drive these vehicles as volunteers.
Yeah, it's beautiful. So the gospel makes a difference.
Yes. It sure does. It sure does.
Yeah, the contrast between your students and the surrounding youth culture is extraordinary. Why did you choose business and social work as the first two majors at the university?
Because that's what our Russian trustees asked for.
Okay.
We went to them, and when we organized our board of trustees, we said, how should we begin the school? And they said, do two things for us. Teach us about business and economics so we can generate some income in our churches and in our communities.
Right.
And number two, we have so many social problems in our country. Please train our people to deal with drug addiction and child abuse and so forth and so on. So that was their choice. And then about 2 years later, they said, teach us to be bilingual. We need to know English as well.
Mm-hmm.
So then we added the English program.
Okay.
So that's how that began. That's what the Russians wanted. And we did what they wanted.
How is the university doing today?
It's closed.
It had to close. Tell me about that.
Yep. Yeltsin and Gorbachev invited us in, and Putin kicked us out.
Wow.
In 2010, basically, the Kremlin closed us down. And not just us, by the way, a number of other private schools. They did two things to us, Al. Number one, when we were going through the reaccreditation process, we had 120 American faculty who had taught at our school as volunteers in the mm-hmm. first 15 years, and they said, we don't recognize their PhDs. We don't recognize their degrees.
They wouldn't recognize the U.S. PhDs.
Yeah, and I'm saying your kids go to Princeton, University of Michigan, and Chicago, and we don't recognize them. So that meant we couldn't qualify to be reaccredited, number one. Number two, they took away our tax exemption. We had just built a building. It had taken us 10 years to build this campus facility. It's a beautiful facility. And our property tax was $2,000 a year because we were a nonprofit corporation.
Right, right.
They took away the tax-exempt status, and our tax bill went from $2,000 a year to $500,000 a year.
Wow.
And the board said, we're done.
It's extortion.
But you know what's happened, though? We had to close the school down, obviously.
Yeah.
But we sold the facility, and we've taken that money, and we've put it into a foundation.
Mm-hmm.
And now we're giving grants to Christian educational programs all over Russia, Ukraine, and the post-Soviet world. So we're doing more now than we thought we were doing then.
Really? So the death, he had the death of a vision, but the resurrection of the whole purpose of it.
Absolutely, yeah. I talked about that in the last chapter of the book. It's the legacy. And I want to tell you, all of us, including my trustees, are saying we had no idea when the school closed down that we would be doing more now than we thought we could do then.
Let me go back to the closing of the school. Did they do the same thing with the Adventist University that was there and the Lithuanian Christian College? Did they give them the same problems?
Fortunately for Lithuania, they were able, they're in Lithuania, so they're outside the reach of the Russian government.
Okay.
So, and we helped fund them, by the way. It's a wonderful school. And in fact, when we closed our school, probably 15 or 20 of our students immediately transferred to Lithuania.
Yeah.
Okay. The Adventist school had a little different status than we had because they basically registered as a theological school, and they were able to escape from the law that affected private education.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. So there were a couple other private schools that operated illegally with these laws by bending the rules and paying people off. And our board said, we're not going to do that.
Not going to do it, right.
We're here to live with integrity, and we're not going to do that.
This is so...
Can I add one little thing for you quickly?
Yeah, please,
because
go ahead.
I think your audience, we have built a beautiful relationship with Ukrainian Catholic University.
Oh, yeah.
In Lviv, Ukraine.
No, that's good to hear.
It is an amazing school. And we are giving them grants right now and helping them to build their program.
Yes.
And it's just a great joy to have Protestants and Catholics work shoulder to shoulder.
Yeah, indeed.
On some of these issues.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. George Weigel championed the Ukrainian Catholic University when he's been on this program. And so we have discussed
it. He's a great guy.
Yeah, yeah. So we have discussed it before. Tell me a little bit about how these grants work that you're using now.
Well, we have a nonprofit corporation, and when we find out about projects, people recommend projects to us, or we learn about projects, we touch base with them, do a little research on what they're doing, and then if it looks like it's close to our mission, which focuses on higher education, mm-hmm. Christian higher education, then we invite them to submit a grant application. And then the Board of Trustees, we have 9 trustees, then reviews these grants and then makes grant applications. So that's what we do right now. And we've been doing that now since 2015.
Wow.
So it's a great joy. You know, I had to raise money for 25 years. Now I can give it away.
that's a lot more fun.
Oh, yeah.
It's a lot more fun. I'm curious, when you bring a Christian university to a country that has been officially atheistic, there must be a clash of worldviews there that you've got to deal with. How'd the students deal with that? I mean, they were probably in the grammar school years. They were part of an official atheistic regime. And somewhere along the line, it sounds like they received the gospel. And now they're in a Christian university. Was there time spent helping them think worldviewishly, if you will?
Oh, yes. I mean, now, the kids that came into our school, again, were Protestants, Catholics, and Orthodox. So they came from various Christian families. So they had kind of the basics of a Christian faith, but they had never been taught about how to integrate that faith with their worldview.
Right, right.
So they come to a school like ours, and they are so excited. I mean, they have never seen this kind of stuff before. And just to give you a practical example, I remember one of the first classes that I went into, a philosophy professor was talking about different Christian views on baptism and on the sacraments, and explaining what the Catholics believe and the Protestants believe, what the Orthodox, and these students were saying, we never heard this before. They were so excited to learn from these different traditions.
Yeah.
And of course, our challenge to them was to say, now you have to take these skills that you have and commit them to your country to make it a democratic place, a safe place, where there's freedom of religion. That's got to be your job.
Yeah.
And they were very excited about that opportunity. So we were planting seeds for leadership for the next generation.
Have these young men and young women, flourished in Russia now?
Some have, but I have to tell you that probably a quarter to a third of them have left.
Okay.
And I'm very sad about that.
They've left the country?
I think they'll...
They've left the country or left the faith?
I think they'll come back.
Okay.
They'll come back when Putin is gone.
Okay.
But they were no opportunities for these people. I mean, so they went to Germany, England, Canada, United States, and they're prospering right now in those places because they're such bright students.
Yeah.
It's hard for me to know, Al, what's going on with those students in Russia now because I can't communicate with them.
I see.
You know, my faculty, hundreds of students, they can't honestly talk to me through emails because they know it's all being checked by security.
It's that bad.
So it's a much more difficult thing for me to be able to really know what's going on in their lives. And my last two trips to Russia, I was followed by security police the whole time I was there. So they're tracking any contact with foreigners right now very carefully. But, you know, Putin is not going to live forever.
Right, right.
And we were preparing for the future by planting these seeds.
Yeah, yeah. Putin is one of these strong men that seems we see them throughout world history. They're emperors. They're new Caesars. It's been said that he may be the richest man in the world. Is he by your knowledge, is he benefiting from this corruption over there?
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah.
Absolutely. Yeah. I saw some statistics a couple of days ago which said that he is by far the richest man in the world.
Yeah. Yeah.
I mean, he makes some of these millionaires like Bezos and Buffett and Gates look like misers. And, I mean, the estimates are hard to know because so much of his money is hidden in these offshore shell corporations.
Yeah.
But the guy's got billions of dollars. Billions.
Well.
And all of his buddies do as well. So a lot of it is in offshore accounts. And so, but this is going to come out. Sooner or later, this is going to come out.
That's right. That's right. And the good news is that you had a wonderful opportunity there. The Lord led you in a beautiful way. The gospel was received. People grew in their faith. And you're now able to continue to help people. John, wonderful talking with you. It's a great story. Thank you.
Well, thank you for the opportunity to spend time with you and your listeners.
Beth, why is our health insurance so expensive? Our premium and deductible are so high. Plus, I don't want my family to support a company that doesn't share our values.
Kim, there is another option. Check out CMF Curo. It's an affordable Catholic healthcare ministry where members share their medical costs in community, and it's pro-life. We joined last year and have saved thousands, all without compromising our values. Just go to MyCatholicHealthcare.com.
CMF Curo sounds exactly like what our family needs.
Yeah, that's MyCatholicHealthcare.com.
This program is brought to you in part by Charity Mobile, a proud partner of Ave Maria Radio for over 10 years. Charity Mobile is the pro-life cell phone company, and has sent nearly $2 million to thousands of pro-life charities. 4G LTE coverage is available nationwide, and 5% of your monthly plan cost goes to your favorite pro-life charity. A video introduction is available at CharityMobile.com. Charity Mobile, everyday living, effortless giving. CharityMobile.com.
The EWTN home video highlight for October is the EWTN Family Celebration from Denver, Colorado. John Ed Williams, Father Mitch Pacwa, Dr. David Anders, Father Innocent, Father Augustino, and Father Angelus show us how faith can move mountains. Order your DVD at EWTNRC.com 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, or call 1-800-854-6316.
If you believe in the power of prayer, Ave Maria Radio invites you to look at their website to submit a prayer request at AveMariaRadio.net. Your prayer requests are shared with hundreds at the Dominican Sisters of Mary, Mother of the Eucharist, the Servants of God's Love, the Monastery of the Blessed Sacrament Cloistered Nuns, the Family of Faith Apostolate, and the staff of Ave Maria Radio. Just go to AveMariaRadio.net and click on the Community tab to submit your prayer request today.
In 2017, we filed a federal civil rights lawsuit against the city of Sterling Heights, Michigan, and its mayor, alleging violations of federal and state law. The lawsuit was filed on behalf of seven city residents who opposed the construction of a large mosque in their Chaldean Christian neighborhood. It was evident then, as it is now, that the American Islamic Community Center, or AICC, wanted to plant the flag in this community of Christians who fled Islamic persecution in Iraq. In February 2017, the city decided not to defend against the specious claims of discrimination made by AICC and the Obama Department of Justice in their lawsuits filed against the city, but instead to capitulate and enter into a consent judgment that granted AICC permission to build the mosque, even though doing so violated local and state zoning regulations. The decision to enter into the consent judgment was made during a city council meeting in which the mayor enforced a speech restriction that prohibited private citizens, including our clients, from making any comments that the mayor deemed critical of Islam in direct violation of the First Amendment. The district court ruled in favor of the city in an opinion fraught with egregious errors. A three-judge panel of the U.S. Court of Appeals affirmed on August 14th of this year. We promptly filed a petition asking the entire Sixth Circuit to take up this important case. I'm Robert Muse, co-founder and senior counsel for the American Freedom Law Center, bringing you this Faith and Freedom Minute. You can learn more about the American Freedom Law Center and its fight for your faith and freedom by visiting our website and liking us on Facebook.
Hi, I'm Al Cresta. The Catholic faith has enemies. We're Catholics. We have enemies. They are a danger to the faith. And yet we're called to defend the faith, to instruct the ignorant, and to love our enemies. These enemies abuse divine revelation, they abuse science and religion, they abuse our history and our past, they abuse power and wealth. We have to learn how to deal with our enemies by picking up a copy of my book, Dangers to the Faith. You can find it online at AveMariaRadio.net. And a good afternoon to you. I'm Al Cresta, the American Freedom Law Center. Has been especially busy lately. Joining me right now is Rob Muse, co-founder of the American Freedom Law Center and co-author of Offensive and Defensive Lawfare, Fighting Civilizational Jihad in America's Courts. He has previously served 13 years in the U.S. Marine Corps, and you can follow his work at AmericanFreedomLawCenter.org. Rob, good to have you back here. Thanks.
It's always great to be with you, Al.
You've been doing quite a bit. I was looking over your highlights for the month of September, and I thought we should get all this in one package and people can hear, you know, all that you're doing, or at least get a taste of all that you're doing.
Yeah, I appreciate it. Yeah, you know, we've been, since we started back, that's almost 8 years now, I decided every month I would send out a month in review and just kind of hit the highlights.
Yeah.
So, you know, people who follow us and support us, they know, look, we're actually doing something. You know?
That's right.
And so you just happen to pick up the one we sent out highlighting our September sort of accomplishments, as it were. But
sure.
We're staying busy, and you know, I think it's a good way to keep people informed. And just, you know, as an aside, if they want to go to our website, which you mentioned, AmericanFreedomLawCenter.org, and if they sign up for our email alerts, they'll get. We don't inundate inboxes with emails and donation requests and all that, but we do send out highlights, and particularly every month we send out our month in review, which we also post up on our and social media, Facebook page, and the likes. But it keeps, you know, at least people know that this is what we're doing, and keeps them informed.
Yeah, no, it's very good. You filed a response in the California Supreme Court to a request to depublish the California Court of Appeals decision in Center for Bioethical Reform, Inc. versus the Irvine Company. You won an important free speech ruling there. Tell us what this request to depublish is about.
Yeah, it's very interesting because in July of this year, in the California Court of Appeals, of all places, we won an important free speech, actually precedent-setting free speech case under the California Constitution. Unlike the First Amendment, which only applies to state action and non-public property, California has a much broader liberty of speech clause, which applies to these large shopping centers, which are private, and as against the private owners. And we represented a pro-life group who wanted to display their abortion imagery at these giant shopping centers, and they were prohibited. The malls were owned by the Irvine Company, one of the largest, most powerful companies in Southern California, and they had a prohibition on grisly and gruesome imagery.
Uh-huh.
And we actually had a full trial on that issue. We won on some issues, and we lost on that main issue. And the trial court relied on some dicta, which isn't the holding of another California Court of Appeals, and he felt compelled to have to rely on that to rule against us. So we appealed to the California Court of Appeals, and we won unanimously on that issue. And they held that under the California free speech provision, you cannot prohibit grisly or gruesome imagery. It's a content-based restriction that violates the law. Well, one of the parts of that opinion is we asked for statutory damages under this California statute, and the court denied our request for statutory damages. Again, the main thrust of the case was the free speech issue. But in denying us statutory damages, the court kind of went a little bit beyond what the statute was and ruled in a way that was going to make the statute difficult to apply in other contexts. So little did we know, actually, there was an attorney in California filed a petition via a letter to the California Supreme Court asking them to depublish the decision, which if it's depublished means it won't be precedential. It'll still, we still have the favorable ruling, but it won't have precedential value. And he didn't have any qualms with the free speech issue, which is what the main case was about. He's somebody who does other civil rights kind of litigation, discrimination litigation, and he thought the court's ruling on the statutory penalties was going to be problematic. So it's kind of an interesting situation.
Yeah.
So we responded. So the California Supreme Court basically granted itself till October 31st to decide whether it could take the whole case up and rehear it again. It could take it up and just rehear on the statutory provision argument, which would be fine with us because, you know, we could ultimately win that in the California Supreme Court.
Mm-hmm.
So it's a very it's kind of an interesting posture. It was something it kind of came about unexpectedly when we were waiting for the case to be remanded back down to the trial court, which should have happened in early September. It was held up, and we're trying to figure out why, and then we found out when the mailings came in that there was this petition pending in the California Supreme Court. So it's really, it's interesting. Hopefully, hopefully they don't disturb the free speech ruling because that's the thrust of the case, and it was a very important ruling. But who knows, maybe at the end of the day, we'll end up getting statutory damages out of it. So that's, so that's all out in California. Go figure.
Very good. So, yeah.
Yeah, there's some successes there.
On September 18th, you filed a federal civil rights lawsuit against the city of Detroit and several city police officers. You were challenging their enforcement of various restrictions that prohibited pro-lifers from engaging in free speech during the Democratic presidential candidate debates last July at the Fox Theater in Detroit. I remember the event. Tell me what Detroit was doing there.
Right. Well, we were representing a pro-life group, Created Equal. The founder is Mark Harrington. Mark Harrington was a client of mine previously,
yep.
and he runs a pro-life group that does similar, engages the public with, abortion-related imagery to show them the truth of abortion.
Yes.
And he does a fantastic job. And they've been going to all these presidential debates. And as you know, the Democrat presidential candidate debate was at Fox Theater in July of this year. And I think it was the 30th and the 31st. And they put in place these absurd draconian restrictions. You couldn't get anywhere near this place.
Huh.
And so they were blocking out areas which are truly traditional public forums. It's interesting because right in the Fox Theater they had this big open parking lot area which is a public parking lot which they could have easily allowed the protesters as it were to be in there, but they blocked that all out and gave it to CNN essentially and the media. So the whole Fox Theater, they insulated all the people who were attending the Fox Theater, obviously the presidential candidates and everybody from any of the protesters that were out there, and even to make matters worse, in fact, they threatened to arrest Mark Harrington one time because he was going to go to a public sidewalk, which was close to where the Fox Theater was. They put him in handcuffs and told him that, they'll take him to the police station if he doesn't agree to leave. And he said, okay, I'll leave, and they let him out of the handcuffs. And he moved on. They said, you have to go to this designated free speech area that we created, like three or four blocks away, nowhere within
right.
sight, sound of the Fox Theater. And to make matters worse, they had police officers there. On one side of the street, you could actually see the Fox Theater visually. I mean, it was, blocks away, but you at least could see it.
Right.
The other side of the street was behind and to the side of the building where you couldn't even see the Fox Theater. You had a police officer there, and if you had a sign that appeared to be something that supported the candidates, you got to go on the good side of the street. And if you had a sign that they thought was contrary to what the candidates were saying, and they looked at his, pro-life signs, they sent you to the other side of the street, and you were totally in the dark. And so you have these viewpoint-based restrictions that are based on the subjective view of the police officer on top of these draconian restrictions. And to make matters worse, right, their claim was, well, it's for safety. It wasn't for safety. After everybody was safely inside, doors closed, everything else, and couldn't see any of the signs, they lined everybody up based on their viewpoint, whether you were, pro-Democrat, which you went first, and if you were anti-Democrat, you went second. And they let them march, once quickly across the front of Fox Theater and then block the place off again. It was almost like a joke that they did that.
Yes, yes.
But it just goes to show it undermines whatever safety reasons they had, right? Were they concerned? And they didn't have any, inspections where they inspected backpacks or
right.
any of those things where it actually where they might have had a legitimate safety reason
sure.
for keeping everybody blocks and blocks away. So anyway, so we sued them, and we're in the process of serving the complaint now. This was just the most latest lawsuit. Mark's been to other places. He's been to Houston. He's been, I think there was one coming up in Columbus. And it was totally different. He said Detroit was the worst place that they've been in terms of how they were treating the protesters.
Hmm.
And so we got that lawsuit going.
When do you think that will be heard and litigated, argued?
Yeah, it takes, obviously these things take time. And so I always tell my clients, civil litigation does not move quickly.
Yeah, okay.
We sent the complaint out for service. They have 30 days to respond to the service request, and then they'll have several weeks to even file their response.
Yeah.
And whether they respond as a motion to dismiss or, I mean, it's these things take years to get final resolution. Hopefully,
sure,
at the district court level, within a year, we could get a ruling on this. Because you know this, and we want to move this along actually quickly because it's a free speech issue. And principally, Michigan is an important state in this,
yes,
upcoming 2020 election, as we know.
Absolutely.
Right? Time and time again. And Detroit is a population center, and it's no doubt going to be a place where the candidates, both, you know, President Trump and like whoever the contenders are, will show up there, you know, over the next year. And if Detroit's going to keep putting in these draconian restrictions that keep protesters, particularly pro-life protesters, from having their voices heard during these, then, you know, we want to get that resolved sooner rather than later.
Yeah, very good. On September 30th, you filed a notice of supplemental authority in your lawsuit against Dana Nessel, the Michigan Attorney General, and Augustin Arbula, the director of the Michigan Department of Civil Rights. Why?
Well, this was we have a lawsuit which we filed in February this year against Dana Nessel, the Michigan Attorney General, and the director of the Michigan Department of Civil Rights. And on February 22nd, I believe it was, they put out an official press release announcing, and Dana Nessel has created this so-called hate crimes unit, and the director of the Michigan Department of Civil Rights has created this hate incident database where the government is going to keep a database on people that are part of quote-unquote hate groups, and they expressly said they're going to rely on the Southern Poverty Law Center designation of the hate groups. And in this press release, this official announcement, they had hyperlinks to the so-called hate map and to the so-called intelligence report of the Southern Poverty Law Center. And if you look at the hate map, there's 31 groups operating in Michigan, which they've mentioned, according to the Southern Poverty Law Center, which the government mentioned in their press release. And number one on the list is the American Freedom Law Center. It's absolute absurd. You've got, you know, this George Soros-funded propaganda machine, leftist progressives, the Southern Poverty Law Center. You know, it's one thing for them to engage in their political propaganda, but then now when you have government officials who are going to officially rely on that to, you know, target law-abiding citizens as hate groups, now our constitutional rights are triggered. So
That's
we sued
right.
her in February. Interestingly, and this goes to show you, you know, what you get when you elect a progressive liberal to office, Dana Nessel is weaponizing the office of the Michigan Attorney General. A couple of years ago, when there was, as I know your listeners, because I've discussed this before, about the importance of having statutory protection for religious liberty, like the Religious Freedom Restoration Act. We have a federal one. A lot of states have them. Some of them don't have them broad enough. Michigan doesn't have one broad enough. They were trying to get one passed. Governor Snyder would not do that, but they passed a law which granted special religious freedom protection to organizations that adopt children, that provide, you know, adoption agencies, particularly for Catholic adoption agencies who objected to wanting to place children into, you know, so-called same-sex marriage households. Well, and those laws have been upheld across the country. And the ACLU challenged it, and the then Governor Schuette was defending it. Well, when the election turned around, Dana Nessel came in, and rather than abiding by what her obligation and duty was to defend the laws of the legislature, she entered into a settlement agreement with the ACLU, had the case dismissed, and agreed that she's not going to enforce this law.
Yeah.
And so then one of the groups, St. Vincent's, a Catholic group, sued because she can't do that. I mean, that is unlawful, and this a judge on September 26th in the Western District of Michigan, a federal judge ruled in favor of St. Vincent and granted a preliminary injunction against this settlement agreement. And very interestingly, because in there, one of the things that the government, who was representing Dana Nessel, the state government, they wanted to dismiss her. And in that decision, the judge denied the request to dismiss, and this is what he said, because he said, based on the evidence that was before him, quote, it supports a strong inference that St. Vincent was targeted based on its religious belief and that it was defendant Nessel who targeted it,
wow,
quote. And they went on to say, quote, leading up to and during the 2018 general election campaign, Nessel made it clear that she considered beliefs like St. Vincent's to be the product of hate, end quote.
Wow.
So we filed this notice with our court because obviously there's similarities between this. You can see how she's weaponizing her office to go after people whose political and religious beliefs she disagrees with personally, describing them in hate, as hate, and actually taking adverse actions against them.
Yeah.
So we
got about 30 seconds, Rob.
Incredible decision. So anyway, so we filed that in our case to let the court know, say, look, be aware of this decision. It's in the same court that we're in, and this is the way that Dana Nessel operates. She weaponizes the Michigan Attorney General office.
Great job. How do people stay in touch with you?
Yeah, best go to the website, AmericanFreedomLawCenter.org. Sign up for our email alerts, and you'll be getting notices like these that we just went through today.
Very good. Thanks, Rob.
All right. Thanks, Al. Thanks for having me.
Rob Muse, co-founder of the American Freedom Law Center. Again, AmericanFreedomLawCenter.org, or check it out in the Cresta Guest Archives. I'm Al Cresta.
Christ is the answer with Father John Ricardo.
In the midst of our culture today, in this age of relativism, which wants to grant Jesus some significance, but not so much, so we'll give him wise man, great leader, inspiring preacher, great teacher, prophet. You don't get that option when you claim to be God. What reasons do we have to believe that he is who he said he is? And it's important, again, to employ the use of our reason and to understand that faith is not blind. My faith, and please God, the faith of everyone here, is not blind. It rests on something. It rests on a number of things, not least of which is my own experience of God, but it also has something substantial which can be claimed through history. We're not talking about a galaxy long, long ago, far, far away when we talk about Jesus. We're talking about a precise moment in history which has been testified to by countless testimonies, and you and I have access to them.
Dr. Ray Guarendi.
If I disciplined consistently, I'd be disciplining constantly. If I were consistent in my discipline, that would mean I would discipline more, and I'd be disciplining him often. The exact opposite is the case. More consistent discipline leads to less constant discipline. Why? Because you're predictable. The child knows if he does A, you'll do B. That is why. When you are predictable in your authority, you will actually have to use that authority less. Consistent discipline leads to less constant discipline. The more you act when you need to act, the less you will have to act in the future with similar misbehavior.
Good afternoon, I'm Al Cresta. Thank you for joining me, and let me remind you, you can follow up on all of our conversations by going to AveMariaRadio.net. Go to the Cresta Guest Archives and see what you can find there to help take you a little bit deeper into the various topics that we touched upon today. Taking a look, again, at this remarkable story of the Christian Liberal Arts University opening up in Moscow, and of course the follow-up questions with Rob Muse in the field of the law. Let me remind you that as I go off the air, we have Catholic Answers Live coming right up. Michael Naughton talking about work and leisure. And then tonight on EWTN Radio and Television, it's going to be Father Spitzer's Universe. I hope you'll be joining us on Monday for another edition of Cresta in the Afternoon. Mark Hart will be joining us, taking a look at the 99 Handbook, A Catholic Guide to a Life of Faith on Earth. I'll see you then.
Cresta in the Afternoon is a co-production of Ave Maria Radio and EWTN Radio and carried across the EWTN Global Catholic Radio Network. To follow up on any of the guests or information presented on today's program, visit the Cresta Guest Archive at AveMariaRadio.net. That's AveMaria Radio.net. To listen to this or any other edition of Cresta in the Afternoon, visit the audio archives at AveMariaRadio.net. Or to order a CD of the program, call 734-930-4506 or email orders at AveMariaRadio.net. That's 734-930-4506 or orders at AveMariaRadio.net.